Chapter 8. Back in heaven, and the party did indeed go on and on till the break of dawn. And you best believe that no one throws a party like God. That great brimming bronze bowl full of strawberry punch, laced with a kind of all-natural super-strength MDMA from the boss's personal stash. It blasted you to the fucking moon within 30 minutes, kept you there for 6 straight hours, and involved no come-down whatsoever. It was so good that God had indeed kept it for himself. They danced on tabletops. They drained the bar, which was, of course, instantly, magically restocked. No one makes dawn runs to dubious all-night liquor stores in heaven. They sang themselves hoarse, Jesus at one point being carried around the room during the Rose's I Am the Resurrection. And they all took turns in corners and on sofas, telling each other how much they loved one another. Sometime around daybreak, JC finds himself stretched out on a beanbag, talking about the meaning of life with a mad, totally random old group. Big Bob, John Belushi, Gandhi, a cab driver called Max, the former British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, Abe Lincoln, a couple of the Bronte sisters, wild, wild chicks, man, and Dean Martin. Martin is telling a story about some orgy he'd been to once, and Chamberlain, who isn't handling the strawberry punch too good, is saying, I feel rather, sideways at the moment. When God comes over and takes his son by the elbow. Got a minute? They stumble off down the hall towards God's office. Daylight streaming in through the cracks in the drapes as they pass a couple rolling around on a chaise longue.
Guys, God says, get a room.
Jesus flops down in one of the easy chairs facing God's desk, yawning, beat but happy, as God goes into the little cocktail cabinet behind his chair and brings out the good scotch.
The very good scotch, JC sees,
bottled in 1889. What's up, Dad?
I thought we'd have a little nightcap and catch up on recent events, God says,
handing JC a crystal tumbler of the centuries-old malt. He helps himself to an enormous Cohiba, takes a seat next to his son, and thumbs the remote control. The bank of screens on the wall lights up, and they settle back to watch selected news footage from Earth, where, of course, some 30 years have passed since they got the party started last night. His legend had really kicked up a gear with the disappearance of his body from the Huntsville morgue. Conspiracy theories a go-go. Internet meltdown. All that shit. Then there were the guys. Bex and Morgan had broken into the abandoned, burned-out ranch near Brunsville and gotten the hard drive recorder from the base of one of the big wind turbines. The hard drive recorder that was linked to the digital camera on top of the turbine. The camera that had, like Pete thought, been pointing the right way at the back of the house, giving a wide, high, master shot of the whole fucking mess. The footage was clear, sharp, and unarguable. The helicopter gunship strafing the compound, the huge sizzling rounds tearing the building apart, JC clearly visible as he disarmed Rennett and threw the rifle away, the tank opening up with its flamethrower, spraying fire into a timber structure where women and children were hiding. That was the bit that every news service in the world played over and over again, usually followed by the clip of the BATF and FBI directors being interviewed in the wake of the atrocity. Stanley Taus from the FBI saying,
categorically, we did not use unreasonable force.
Don Gerber from BATF saying,
we did not burn that building down.
Gerber resigned first. Taus soon after, later committing suicide. The attorney general was fired and then subjected to prosecution for her role in greenlighting the disaster. Then the footage of Becky, Morgs, and Chris on the interview circuit, on chat shows, news programs, Breakfast with America. The bestseller Becky wrote about her life with JC. People wearing the t-shirt saying, be nice. Bumper stickers saying the same thing. Stephen Stelfox's U-turn was breathtaking in its audacity. He posthumously released the demos they'd recorded in Texas, calling Jesus a modern American folk hero, saying how he'd always, deep down, believed in his innocence and greatness. He called the album The Vindication, and it spent 32 weeks at number one, going on to sell 15 million copies in the United States, several million more around the world, becoming one of the biggest-selling records of all time, earning Stelfox a fortune to complement the one he already had. Then God saying,
"Shit, look at this,"
as he freezes the frame and zooms in on a shot of a heaving Times Square, getting closer on an overweight woman making her way through the lunchtime rush. Closer on her face, Jesus not quite understanding what he's so excited about until he sees it dangling from a chain around her neck. A silver syringe. "Oh, shit. You gotta be kidding me," JC says. Then they're both howling with laughter, slapping their thighs and falling about on the floor and gasping for air as the door opens behind them and Lance comes in with a sheaf of papers. "Oh, fuck," God says, wiping a tear.
"That's too good. Man, I almost wish they had electrocuted you. Bitch would have a fucking chair around her neck."
"Gee, thanks, Dad. What are you hets cackling about?"
"Ah, human stuff. They sure do love to worship, don't they?" "Thanks, Lance," God says, taking the papers.
"The overnight numbers," Lance says, God already expertly sifting through the figures. "You'll be happy. The kid done good." "Right, boys. I am off to bed. Alone, sadly."
"Later, dude," JC says as Lance shuts the double doors behind him.
God is indeed happy. A sports nut, he loves his stats.
"Well then," he says, "we're up on admissions by 22.8% on the previous half day."
The half day referring to approximately 28 years on Earth, of course.
"Peter's estimating we'll increase that by another 7 to 8% in the coming 24 hours. Looks like the SOBs are actually playing nicer."
"Well, good to know it wasn't a total waste of time."
"Hell no, son." God looks at his watch. "Is it too early to..." "Nah, fuck it. Let's give the little prick a call."
Genie has the day off to recover from the party, like the rest of his outer office, so God dials the three digits himself, the huge video conferencing screen lighting up as soon as he taps the last six. A few rings, then a bleary-eyed Satan answers. He's in a kimono, sitting on the edge of his bed.
"Morning, scumbag," God says brightly. "Didn't wake you, did we?"
"Fuck you," Satan says.
There's something in the bed behind him, a horse or something.
"The fuck you wanted this time?"
"Sin never sleeps, pal. How's your numbers looking?"
Get fucked," Satan says, yawning.
"'Cause from where I'm sitting, you gotta be down, 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 buddy."
"Yeah, yeah. Laugh it up, fucko. This shit ain't over. It's a marathon, not a sprint. I'm going back to bed. Why don't you two go fuck each other, and I'll see you in hell?"
Come on. Don't be like that," God says. "Come up for dinner tonight?"
"Maybe," Satan says. "I'll call you. Now fuck off."
The screen goes black. God says, rubbing his hands together merrily.
"It's the little things that get you through."
"Right, Dad. I'm gonna hit the hay."
"Yeah, get some rest. Your buddies will be here soon."
"Shit, of course. Becky, Morgs, Chris, all in their 60s now. They'd be here by the time he woke up." "Night, Dad. You should turn in too, you know."
"Yeah, won't be long. Good night, son."
God smiles as he watches his boy shuffle off to bed, and then he takes his drink and cigar across to the French windows behind his desk, overlooking the emerald orchard where the souls of toddlers and tiny babies play. He watches them gurgle and gambol in the morning light, squeaking with delight among the flowers.
Many of them had met violent deaths, burned alive in house fires, beaten until their delicate spines broke or their chests caved in, drowned in dunned canals, in rivers the color of lead, strangled with bunched, tattooed fingers. Some gassed in ovens, and others sundered with machetes or shot with automatic weapons at close range. All perfect and unscarred here, of course. The infants are the luckiest ones, really. The ones who get to grow up in heaven. Who will never know anything else. Why do babies on earth cry? The thought causes God to remember a line from John Updike, whose work he's been enjoying very much recently. Nice guy. Decent, honest golfer, too. The kind of fellow who won't take a gimme if he thinks there's a chance he'd miss it. He thinks of the line now as he stands in the dawn sun, savoring the last drop of that good scotch, the last couple of inches of the Cuban. As souls must cry when they awaken in tiny babies and find themselves far from heaven. Literature. Now that was some good shit. He was glad they'd come up with that.
The Second Coming is published by Random House Audiobooks, a division of the Penguin Random House Group. Copyright John Niven, 2011. Copyright and recording, Random House Audiobooks. John Niven has asserted